From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll examine how presidential rhetoric can impact how we view the office as an institution or as an individual.
When you start getting into the territory that you yourself are the definitional actor of what's good or right or moral, that can pose some challenges to how we think about our democratic structures.
Then we'll talk to a Wisconsin dairy farmer about what a mass deportation would mean for those who rely on immigrant workers. Plus, we'll speak with Mariana Rodriguez, who was honored with a Betty Award for her work in supporting victims of domestic violence.
Where I'm at today is because of all of those families that have come through the center. I am so deeply grateful to them for who I am right now as a woman and as a leader.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Many states slowly turned red election night as results rolled in. A blue wave of votes from mainly urban communities rolled in later, but it wasn't enough to overcome votes for Donald Trump. This was true here in Wisconsin, where you could see a clear urban-rural divide in how people voted. According to Kathy Kramer, author of The Politics of Resentment, research shows that rural communities have an increasing resentment towards urban areas, who seemingly have greater resources, respect, and political power. This divide reflects how people make their choices in the voting booth, and Kramer joins me now to break down how the urban-rural divide played out locally. Kathy, welcome to Lake Effect.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me to be with you.
So with the election this week, obviously, we are looking into a lot of what unfolded. And one takeaway for Wisconsin in particular is that this marks the fifth time in the past seven presidential elections that a presidential election has been decided by less than a point. What's your takeaway from that?
My takeaway is Wisconsinites should hold on. And if they're sick of politics, like... from elections for the foreseeable future, we are going to be in the spotlight and experience all kinds of candidate visits and campaign ads. And we are a crucial state in presidential elections for sure.
So I suppose the near constant visits from the campaign, sometimes within the same day, didn't surprise you too much. In the same place, yeah.
Yes, I think that's going to continue.
So, you know, it's probably not unique to Wisconsin, but I have to say one surprising takeaway was the ticket splitting, where people voted for Donald Trump for president, but Tammy Baldwin, who is a Democratic senator, was also reelected. Do you have any insights to share on this? You know, did Tammy effectively navigate this urban-rural divide that we have?
She does seem to be skilled at doing that. And part of it is simply like the power of incumbency, where people are very familiar with her relatively compared to other politicians and know of her as one of our senators, right? And so people, even if people are skeptical of politicians from both parties, they tend to prefer the devil they know to the devil they don't. So that's part of what's going on. But also, Tammy Baldwin has proven time and time again that she resonates with people in a variety of places in the state. And I think it's partly the way she runs her campaigns, but it could also be partly the way that she does her job. And she clearly spends a lot of time in a variety of places in the state. And I think that does matter, because even if you are a Republican, if you feel that the Democratic candidate understands you and people like you in your kind of place, that goes a long way towards giving her your vote.
Right. And your research is specific on the urban-rural divide, and you found that rural communities have an increasing resentment towards urban areas who seemingly have greater resources, respect, and political power. But with Wisconsin always being so close, you know, something that seems to be a big driver in this election was the economy, you know, on that note of greater resources. So do you think this was the key driving factor for voters who chose Republican?
Yes and no. I think the economy was a key driving factor for lots of people, but I think it was a key factor for many people who voted Democratic too. So I say no, because the way people perceive the economy and who's to blame for any economic challenges that they're facing is very much colored by which party they lean toward in their own kind of, you know, like the lens, the partisan lens through which they interpret politics. So people across the board, regardless of political leanings, are facing economic challenges these days. But, you know, what they do with that politically really depends on the leaders that they look to and kind of the arguments that they're buying in terms of who is to blame for the challenges they're facing.
So in addition to this urban-rural divide that swing states like Wisconsin go through and experience, what about the gender divide? How did that present itself in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I don't know specifically yet a comparison of how women in Wisconsin voted, but just looking at the exit polls for the nation as a whole, one thing that surprised me, honestly, with a woman of color at the top of the Democratic Party ticket, is how the gender gap this time around was not that different than in previous presidential elections. And by the gender gap, I just mean the difference in the percent of women who voted for the Democratic ticket compared to men, or you could also think of that in terms of support for the Republican Party. And, you know, especially with abortion being such an important issue right now, we really expected to see a larger gender gap. And, you know, early interpretations of what happened is that Donald Trump did a good job of distancing himself from that issue. And basically the Republican Party's anti-abortion or pro-life stance on that issue. So the gender gap was there, but not in a very different way than it's been in recent presidential elections.
So the ways the divide is being used and tapped into for political gain kind of varies, but in your work, having been studying this since 2007 up to now and continuing on, what are your observations of how this has either changed or increased? Are you looking at different trends within this? Just, yeah, what have you been noticing as the Republican Party has been significantly changing, yeah, especially?
So with respect to the rural-urban divide, it definitely seems to have grown in Wisconsin in terms of electoral returns and across the country. But I now understand in more recent research that I've been doing, not necessarily partly focused on the rural-urban divide, but more generally trying to understand where our current political divides in this country have come from. I now understand that that rural-urban divide is part of something much broader, which in part can be characterized by the college gap, which is people with a four-year college degree, especially white people with a four-year college degree, increasingly leaning towards the Democratic Party, and people without a four-year college degree, especially white people without a four-year college degree, increasingly leaning toward the Republican Party. And because of the nature of our economy, honestly, and where the jobs are and the types of jobs, it tends to be the case that people in a more urban community are more likely to have a college degree, and also more likely to lean toward the Democratic Party. So our rural-urban divide in many ways is growing, but it's part of a more fundamental divide in our country that's partly cultural, partly about college education, and partly economic as well.
You've pointed out that this us versus them cycle can be good politics for winning elections, but it actually hurts people living in these communities in the long run. So what do you feel are the greater and immediate implications of these election results right now? What are you keeping an eye out for?
Just how much people can have trust in one another, in their neighborhoods, in their communities, within the state. There's just an enormous amount of distrust in our political systems, in a variety of institutions, right? That's been growing not just in the last 8 years, but for a longer time. But the level of distrust is really concerning. And living in a state that is as politically divided as we are, and the way in which our political divisions line up with so many other important kind of social characteristics in terms of gender in terms of race, in terms of college education. I worry about our ability to continue to see each other as human beings in the state and treat each other with dignity. I hope that we can do that, but our political system is not giving us a whole lot of guidance on how to do that these days.
Certainly is worth plenty of study. That'll keep you busy. Kathy Kramer, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's great talking with you.
Kathy Kramer is the Natalie C. Holton Chair of Letters and Science and the Virginia Shapiro Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison. She's also the author of The Politics of Resentment. As analysis continues of the results of the 2024 election, one thing to be reviewed is how each candidate's campaign and the rhetoric surrounding it impacted the outcome. Former President Donald Trump delivered dark and volatile campaign language that was centered on fear, while Vice President Kamala Harris had an approach centered on optimism and hope. Allison Prash is an associate professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison, whose research seeks to understand how political leaders create and sustain a particular vision of the U.S. through their words and actions. She joins me now to help break down some of the political rhetoric we saw unfold and ultimately what seemed to be the most effective approach. Allison, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you study rhetoric, politics, and culture, but today we're going to get into the specifics of presidential rhetoric. So would you say a major theme of presidential rhetoric overall that has persisted over the last few campaigns is this tension between viewing the U.S. presidency as this grand institution to be upheld versus an individual?
Yeah, that's a great way to describe this tension. And in many ways, I think we could say this goes back further than just the past few campaign cycles. The institution of the presidency in some way is always shaped by the individual occupant. So we have one individual person who's elected to the office and really is representative of that larger institution. But what I would say has happened, especially over the past 8 to 12 years, is really this debate, quite frankly, over do we prioritize the personality of the president and that individual and loyalty and fealty to one individual, or do we really prioritize and value the enduring institutional norms and expectations that we have of the U.S. presidency? And one thing I always tell my students is that the culture or the expectation of an institution is built by the individuals that occupy that institution. And so as we have individual president after individual president, they're going to contribute something to the character of that institution. And then that character will shift in shape as we go throughout history.
And that kind of reminds me of the pendulum that's always talked about, right? Do you see that as part of a factor, or is it more about the rhetoric shifting or influencing that pendulum?
Oh, that's a great question. I think throughout U.S. history, there have definitely been individuals who have shaped the character and understanding of the institution through who they are. So examples for this might be Franklin Roosevelt, for example, in the 1930s, 1940s. You can think about the changes that Ronald Reagan brought to the institution of the presidency. And I think, you know, we're living at a current moment where we think about the ways that Donald Trump has changed the institution and, you know, will do so going forward as he's been elected again president. But I think the thing that is important to keep in mind is that throughout history, the majority of the time, the individuals who are occupying the institution of the presidency have demonstrated in some way, shape, or form that they value that institution. And regardless of how the individuals are speaking or acting, it's always been in the service of the institution. And I think that's something that we really need to pay attention to in our current moment.
Yeah. And on that point, Donald Trump said in a campaign rally, quote, "I'm not running against Kamala. I'm running against an evil democratic system. These are evil people." So it's hard to kind of put those two juxtaposing things together, right?
It is. And I think in particular, what you laid out there in that quote is this idea of a quote, evil democratic system, unquote. It's a little murky what exactly he means and who he is speaking about. Sometimes he's direct in naming individuals and sometimes he is not. In that instance, I think it's very interesting how Trump himself is taking on the position that he gets to be the one who defines what is evil, what is anti-democratic, what the system is. And when you start getting into the territory that you yourself are the definitional actor of what's good or right or moral, that can pose some challenges to how we think about our democratic structures.
Yeah, I mean, that I think has persisted throughout this campaign. And in your work of studying past presidencies, what are your observations about Republican rhetoric historically versus Republican rhetoric under Donald Trump? And do you think these are two different eras now? And if so, what are those distinguishing features?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's very fair to make an argument that we are living in a different era of Republican rhetoric. You know, I think there have been various shifts throughout the 20th century, now the 21st century, in thinking about how presidents address publics. And I think it's also important to note that, you know, really prior to Kennedy, or, you know, a little bit even after that, it was hard often to say this is a Republican brand of rhetoric or this is a Democratic brand of rhetoric. Now, to be clear, people might take issues with particular policies or proposals, but this idea of rhetoric as being politicized is more of a new phenomenon, or the way that it has been weaponized by particular individuals. I think without question, in the second half of the 20th century, we would think about Ronald Reagan and his contributions to how presidents communicate. And one of the defining features of Reagan is that he would often utilize these narratives of hope, American exceptionalism, thinking about kind of a narrative of the United States and its core identities, and who got to be included in that narrative. And one of the reasons that Reagan was so successful as a communicator is that he was able to paint a picture of the, or a vision of the nation that many U.S. Americans could see themselves as a part of. Now, it's also true that in that vision, some individuals were excluded, but Reagan offered this hopeful narrative. And what is striking to me as someone who studies this is to see the dark or fearful narrative of the nation that Trump has really utilized, and he's utilized it in very effective ways, but it's in stark contrast to what Reagan did, where Reagan would offer this hopeful vision of the nation. Trump is doing the opposite. He's essentially saying, you don't have reason to hope. You have every reason to be afraid. And I'm the one who can save you from that fear. And that's why you should support me.
Now, when it comes to rhetoric with these campaigns, it obviously went through a bigger shift once Vice President Kamala Harris became the Democratic Party nominee and President Joe Biden dropped out. And to kind of break down some of the specifics of these rhetoric themes, a big one that was prevalent is gender. But Harris never leaned into this messaging of, you know, gendering herself and leaning on that too hard. And I imagine that's a hard line to toe regardless, but how do you think the gender rhetoric played a role in this race?
Yeah, and I think Harris's walking of that very fine line was quite intentional. If you think back to 2016 and the way that Hillary Clinton would continually describe herself and her campaign, it was always talking about that this was a monumental first, a breaking of the glass ceiling, that this was going to really be this watershed moment in U.S. political history. And regardless of all those things would have been true if Clinton would have won, I think one of the things that happened was that framing her candidacy in that particular way was underscoring this historic first in a way that, quite frankly, for some voters would give them an out to perhaps not support a female candidate. And I think what Harris was doing strategically was essentially leaning into the fact that everyone could see that she is a woman. That's something that's just part of who she is in her candidacy, and then focusing very explicitly on the expertise that she had in various issues. And I think that also is a reflection more broadly about the strides that we have made in talking about gender parity and equality over the last 8 years that helps the electorate see Harris not just as a female candidate, but also the fact that she is a successful individual that doesn't have to be defined by gender.
Yeah, I want to dive into that a little bit more, because with Harris not emphasizing gender and trying to stand on her own record yet distance herself from President Biden, what do you think were some key strategies you thought were strongest or at least most prevalent in her campaign messaging and rhetoric? Or were ineffective?
Yeah. So I think it's important to note here that Harris comes to the nomination only after Joe Biden decides to drop out or is forced to drop out, or a combination of those approaches. And historically, both in contemporary politics, but also in popular culture, it's often the case that female political candidates for the presidency or otherwise are portrayed as being able to be successful in moments of crisis. And so in this particular moment, when Harris ascends to the top of the ticket with just over 100 days to go, and this idea that, okay, well, this is who we have and this is who we should rely on, is further going to underscore the gender dimensions of her candidacy and her campaign in a way that is not going to be the same as if it's a male candidate, quite frankly. And so I think one of Harris's challenges for her was to both lean into the fact that she is a woman and to celebrate that, but not do it too much or not to be too loud or explicit about it. And the other factor here, of course, is that it's not just that she's a woman, but she's a woman of color, of South Asian descent, a father, coming from Jamaica. But then it's also the case that she needs to interact with and defeat in a political arena in an election against someone who has branded himself as this macho masculine figure. And so there are these multiple layers of gender dynamics that are at play here that Harris has to contend with. And she also, the final thing I'll say, she also has to work to distance herself from Joe Biden while also serving as the vice president. And so if we want to talk about the multiple binds that she finds herself in, those would be them: thinking about gender, thinking about race, thinking about this very gendered and at times sexist political contest, and that she is still serving as a sitting vice president. And that's a really tall order.
So speaking of kind of broad packaging, and correct me if I'm wrong or if this is too much of an oversimplification, but if we really whittle down the camps of rhetoric here, Trump has always relied on dark, volatile, attacking rhetoric on minorities, other disenfranchised groups, even political competitors, members of the press, etc. I mean, honestly, there's too many instances to list. And the Harris campaign tried to deliver on optimism and hope. Is fear ultimately more effective than hope throughout history? Or is that our new trend? It's a big question, I know.
It is a big question. That is the question. Here's what I'll say. I'll have a specific answer and then a perhaps more philosophical one. So the more specific answer in the context of 2020 is that I think, yes, a rhetoric of fear was effective. And I think it's not just a rhetoric of fear, but it's also perhaps the ability of Trump to capture feelings within the electorate of anger, distrust, dissatisfaction, a belief that political elites do not see everyday people. I think he is able to package those emotions in a way that makes individuals feel seen and heard. And that often devolves into a rhetoric of fear or anger or hate. Kamala Harris absolutely attempted to brand her campaign and her approach in an opposite way, of offering a narrative of hope, of optimism, belief in the future, in the promise of America, as was one of her taglines. And I think one of the reasons that the campaign probably made that choice is we saw how successful that was for Obama in 2008 and 2012. And yet we see what happened, right? And we see that not only did Donald Trump win the Electoral College, but he won the popular vote. But the more philosophical answer, and this is what I talk to my students a lot about in our classes, is that throughout history, and when we think about and talk about the study of rhetoric, when we go back to some of the people who first thought about rhetoric as an academic or a political practice, and Plato would break this down and say that there is this good rhetoric that is directed towards what is best for the populace or the citizenry, and there's this rhetoric that is used to flatter and make people feel good in the immediate moment and not with a concern for the future. And I really think that the 2024 presidential contest gives us a really clear picture of those two different approaches. And so, yes, it's about a differential between hope and fear, but it's also about a differential between the goals or objectives of people using that language and what their ultimate vision of what rhetoric is and what it can be. Is it just in the service, to go back to the very beginning, just in the service of an individual, or is it to uphold an institution? And I think we have a really clear picture of those two different strategies.
Allison Prash is an associate professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison. We have further analysis and full results from this election at wuwm.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn about the services the Latino Resource Center offers in Milwaukee. But first, President-elect Donald Trump has promised a mass deportation. We'll talk with a Wisconsin dairy farmer about what that could mean for an industry that relies heavily on immigrant workers. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This summer at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, attendees waved signs saying, "Mass deportation now." Donald Trump has promised to launch the largest deportation in U.S. history on the first day of his administration, vowing to deport as many as 20 million people, despite there only being a suspected 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country. John Rosenau's ancestors immigrated to western Wisconsin in the 1850s. His great-grandfather refused to speak English, and his family founded a church that held sermons in German for 60 years. He's now a dairy farmer and has hired immigrant labor primarily from Mexico since the 1990s. He shares how he believes dairy farmers who rely on immigrant workers will be impacted under a mass deportation operation. He starts with a day in the life of a dairy farmer.
My average work day now, since I'm the owner and I do a lot of sitting in the office, is different than it used to be. But it used to be you'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go and milk the cows, feed them and clean them out and stuff like that. And you get done with that maybe by 9, 10 o'clock. And then after that, you do your field work or your mechanical work or anything else you got to do, like go to town. And then you'd milk the cows again at night, approximately 12 hours from when you started in the morning. That was optimum. And that was 7 days a week, holidays always. Everybody locally did the same thing. They were within 3 miles of a radius of my farm, there were 23 dairy farms. And so school had to start at a certain time because people had to get done with chores. Church had to start at a certain time because people had to be done with chores in the morning. And even football games at night had to start at 8 o'clock, so people had time to milk the cows and get to the games. And that's all changed now. I think there's maybe 3 or 4 farms within 3 miles of us now, but the same number of cows.
Well, I can imagine with less farms but the same number of cows that hired labor is more important now for dairy farmers than it was, say, a generation ago.
Absolutely. Probably 20, 25 years ago, things changed dramatically. And we got to be more cows on farms. And that was an economic thing because people, like when I started farming over 50 years ago, the margin was 50%. So if you took in $100,000, you had $50,000 profit. Back 50 years ago, you didn't have that much income, but it still was 50%. Now we're at, on a good year, you're probably getting an 8% margin. So you have to have a lot more animals and a lot more volume in order to make a living nowadays. And so that has changed a lot. And because of that, you'd either have to have 12, 15 kids, or you have to hire people to work for you.
Donald Trump has built a campaign around mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. How could the loss of undocumented immigrants affect dairy farming and all of the industries that directly rely on dairy farming? I'm thinking meat packing, canning, cheese processing. How would these industries be affected by this loss of labor?
It's doing step by step. So they took all the employees away from dairy farms. So the dairy farms would have to sell all their cows. So 90% of the cows in Wisconsin and probably in the country would go away. They would go to packing plants. Packing plants are staffed by immigrants. They're the ones that would have to kill the cows and make it into meat. And the market would be flooded with meat, but there wouldn't be any milk or dairy products or cheese or butter or ice cream to buy. That would go away from our diet. And once all that meat was consumed, that would go away. And all you'd be able to eat basically is corn and beans and some vegetables.
Keeping on the theme of if mass deportations, if Trump's promise of a mass deportation comes true, what effect would the loss of these people mean for your community more generally?
Well, Ashley Furniture would have to shut down. So all the people that work there, I think there's 5,000. I don't know how many are immigrants. They would most likely have to find a different job if they could. Pilgrim's Pride, a chicken processing plant would have to shut down and they would have to find different work. All the farms that are integrated through Pilgrim's Pride with chicken coops that rely on pilgrims to make the mortgage and stuff like that would probably lose their farms. The school would be decimated, and so there would only be 25% or 20% of the number of people living there now. The other part is that a lot of the people, kids in school, are citizens. So if you deport their parents and leave the citizens here that are 10 years old or 8 years old, how are they going to survive? So they would have to follow their parents home, and they're citizens.
In your experience, have you noticed differences in immigration enforcement under Democratic versus Republican presidents?
No. That's the simple answer. There's no. I know of one farm in the last 10 years that they came and checked documents, and he is still farming today, and he's got his documents in order now, but he was really concerned and it cost him quite a bit of money and he almost lost the farm because of it. But I know a lot of people, a lot of farmers, and that's the only one that I know of.
So without seeing differences in immigration enforcement in your region between Democratic and Republican presidents, including Trump, why would someone who hires undocumented labor or depends on an industry that depends on undocumented labor support mass deportations now?
What I've been told by those people is that he doesn't really mean that. Back in 2016 or 20, whenever it was that he was running, he was saying that day one he's going to deport everybody. There was somebody in California that was a big Trump supporter, and he had the dairy farmer. So we called him up and we asked him, you know, why are you saying that you support Trump and he's going to take all your employees away? Oh, he said, Trump assured him that he didn't mean me. And so I would assume that's what people think. But all we can do is go on history. And so he became president. He had the power to do whatever he wanted to, I guess, and he didn't do it. What we found at that point was that our employees became very concerned, and a lot of the people working here left, went home to Mexico, and dairy farmers were running about four or five people short, and everybody else had to pick up the slack, and everybody was working all the time. And then after about 7 or 8 months, everybody's came back because they knew that he wasn't going to do what he said he was going to do, and nothing changed. So I think based on that, we can assume the same thing now.
So if I can paraphrase, and let me know if this is the correct characterization of what you're saying, is that from your perspective, the calls for mass deportation now, it's about fear as much as it is about policy. So the fear that undocumented people, we're going to come after you, so you better self-deport now.
A lot of people have no interaction with immigrants. And so they rely, their opinions are based off of somebody else's opinion. And so they listen to somebody else that badmouths immigrants, and they believe that. And because they haven't taken the time to really get to know an immigrant or study the thing. Because you're busy and you have a lot of things that you want to do in life, and you don't have time to study everything. So some issues don't touch it very much, so you don't worry about it. And one of them is immigration. A person in town or something, or somebody out in the country that never sees an immigrant but watches TV, and they have to have an opinion, so they listen to somebody on TV or somebody online or whatever talk about immigration, and they base their opinions on that.
That was John Rosenow, dairy farmer and owner of Rosenholm Dairy and Cow's Mill Compost in Cochrane, Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods as a part of a special on immigration messaging. You can find more of that special at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then we'll meet the leader of the Latino Resource Center for UMOS, who was recently honored with a Betty Award. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine features the six winners of its 2024 Betty Awards. The awards honor extraordinary women doing remarkable work here in Milwaukee. One of the recipients is Mariana Rodriguez. She's the founder and director of the Latina Resource Center for UMOS, a nonprofit that advocates for underserved people. Rodriguez was recognized for her work in providing support to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking in the Latino community. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez is joined by Rodriguez, who shares how she's seen the Resource Center grow since it opened 23 years ago.
The Latina Resource Center is a comprehensive center that serves victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking. We have three really specific guiding principles of our program, and that is, you know, safety, wellness, and self-sufficiency. And that is really what we strive for when we are working with very, very vulnerable children, youth, and adults.
And is this issue personal to you, or does it touch your life in any way?
It is very personal to me in many different ways. As a survivor myself, as a teen, you know, in my teen years, of dating violence. It's definitely very much a personal mission for me to really reach out to youth and educate them and empower them about information of healthy relationships. And the other part, too, that is extremely personal is the human trafficking, and that my father was a sponsored worker, and that's what led us brought into the United States. And, you know, he experienced a great deal of exploitation and abuse. And, you know, we didn't have that terminology back then. We didn't have the federal law back then of human trafficking. And so everything that my father went through, there's a lot of things that are very much personal to me. I was exposed to a lot of violence in my home, too. So there's a lot of elements of what I do that really comes from a place of, I know this, I've been here, and I think I have something that I can do to help.
Right. Thank you for sharing that with me. And I'm listening to you, and I'm wondering, too, is there someone or something that's helped instill this community service as a value in your life?
My goodness, I love that question, because there isn't anything that I can say it was all me, because I think that there's a lot of people that have really elevated this work and supported me over the years. You know, and I always think about, like, my mom. My mom, it was a person who really pushed me to get an education, to do something, and never, ever let me go, you know. And so I always think about her. But, you know, community service also came from really amazing Latina women that we always had great dialogues about. What are we going to do to support Latina women? How are we going to reach out to these women who are being abused? And Nada Avila, you know, is a longstanding pillar of our organization, of our community. And she has really been the force of why the center is where it's at. She really spoke about the need, rallied up people to support the need of the center, and has always been part of that. But just amazing women that have always played a role in helping shape the center. So there's a lot of great people involved in this success of the center, but also my growth, where I am today. So I'm surrounded by amazing people, and that have really given me the support when I really thought maybe this is too much, or maybe I'm going the wrong direction, because it was often felt very lonely trying to tell the story of our community and the disparities and what we needed to do to really, really help women and victims.
That kind of leads me to my next question of the UMOS Latina Resource Center is the state's first bilingual program for Latina survivors of domestic violence. So you touched on this, but how have you seen this resource grow since the center opened 23 years ago?
Oh, my goodness. We started in one little space, a little corner office. I had no staff. I had just had my daughter. And I think the expectation was very focused to address this. And very quickly, we realized that there were other things that were happening in the lives of victims, sexual assault, immigration needs, poverty, economic support. So all of these things played a role in why it was difficult for women to leave abusive relationships. And so it was actually the victims who really pushed for more and really designed what kind of a center needed to happen to help victims. So it was beyond shelter, because our communities, and often communities of color, shelter is not always the answer, and it has not been the answer. So I like to say that cultural-specific centers like the Latina Resource Center has played a very big role in reshaping the movement of responding to the needs of domestic violence or victims. Mm. So we've evolved. We knew that through the work of UMOS, we have a very strong history of serving farm workers. Migrant women in rural areas were very isolated. So we needed to respond to that. And so going back to funders to say, you know, we need to expand our services to reach these areas where we know there's victims and they're highly isolated. Working with the organization, working with farm workers, we realized that the abuse and exploitation of farm workers in many cases were extremely severe and in very serious crimes were being committed against these workers. And so that's where the work of labor trafficking and human trafficking came in. So I think that I really learned to respect and understand my role in all of this was that my number one job is to listen, is to really listen to our community and really hear what it is that they're saying and how do I strategize to make those things that they need a reality. And so the survivors have really made me grow as a human person, has made me grow to be brave, to work hard. I always say this, where I'm at today is because of all of those families that have come through the center. I am so deeply grateful to them for who I am right now as a woman and as a leader.
Absolutely. So I guess that makes me wonder, what have you seen or heard from the survivors that you work with? Like, what do they need to feel comfortable about coming forward?
They need to feel safe, first of all, and they need to understand their options. And we know that when victims understand their options, they become safer because options and awareness of those and what's available to them, like legal matters, housing matters, then they know that they can approach their situation with some idea of what they're going to do. Because leaving an abusive relationship is a process. It's never an event. It's a process because we know that the times where homicides occur is when women or victims, and I'm sorry that I say women because they continue to be the highest group of victims, but it's the time when they leave when it's the most dangerous time for them. So when they understand that, hey, if you decide to leave, here's a safety plan for you. Here are the names of shelters. If you would have to leave with your children, do you have an idea? Do you have a friend? Do you have a family you could go with temporarily? So these are plans that we walk through with clients.
Well, that's a huge example. So as Milwaukee Magazine's Betty Awards, it is meant to recognize remarkable women in the community supporting other women as you are doing. What does this award mean to you?
You know, this award means a lot in terms of the work that goes into helping build a community to be safer. It means a lot to me because it validates everything that has been done to advocate is impactful. And to me, it's a symbol of what we did together. It's a reflection of an entire community. I don't think it's just about me, but it's giving me the opportunity to share the story of this very small but mighty center.
Before we wrap up, do you have any advice for future generations of women?
My advice is set your vision. What do you see for yourself? Take time to care for yourself, to listen to your voice of what you want, who you want to be, and not allow anybody to keep you from that. Build some great relationships with great people who are going to be very important in this journey of exploring your ideas, because I think that that is what I'm most grateful for, is all of those amazing individuals that believed in me. Because there are times when we don't believe that we can achieve because of internal issues or there's things, life happens. But you have all these individuals that kind of look at you and say, remember, yes, you can, you know. And I think that those are some of the things, you know, get that degree if you want, get that job, do volunteer, support an organization, and just care for yourself.
Si se puede.
Si se puede.
Well, Mariana, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for sharing your work with me.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me the space and to share a little bit of the story of an amazing, amazing center.
Mariana Rodriguez is the founder and director of the Latina Resource Center at United Migrant Opportunity Services, or UMOS. She spoke with Like Effect's Excret Nunez, and you can find an article about Rodriguez and other Betty Award winners in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. And that's Like Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and Excret Nunez join me in producing Like Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayon Silver, Eric Von Fellow, Nadia Kelly, and Susan Bentz from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for some stories about U.S. veterans, including a look at how the Milwaukee Soldiers' Home supported veterans. Plus, we'll learn about the combat con artists of World War II known as ghost armies and how they silently supported the American military. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.